San Antonio, Texas. Thomas Booker on Bond iTunes International.
Thomas Booker for Bond iTunes International. Circa 1973. Downtown San Antonio at the intersection of Houston and Broadway. I got a job at a bookstore, part of a chain with outlets in malls and a store in Austin. But the job I got was at the store in downtown San Antonio. I thought it would be great to work at a bookstore, especially while I attended community college. I was a really screwed up kid, had all sorts of notions as to how the world worked, all of them wrong. But I had a job, and I was out of high school, and I was harboring aspirations, so everything was looking cool. I had been living in San Antonio for about 6 years, and I rarely, if ever, went downtown. But there I was at a busy street corner, traffic, pedestrians, people going about various tasks, chores, shopping, driving, honking horns. A big, burly Polish guy at the San Antonio Police Department looking over the street, directing traffic and upholding order. Friendly, too. I learned the tasks of the store in about a week, and I was assigned to run the store at night and open the store on Sunday mornings. And in time, I was interacting with such people as I never knew existed. A nice couple would occasionally come in looking for a particular book. Another woman would periodically come in asking for a copy of The Little Prince. We never seemed to carry it, even though it was routinely ordered. A gay guy with long, straight black hair came in asking for the latest issue of Dance Magazine and seeing if it had come in. Postal employees on break from down the street would browse, hang out, and talk about something other than mail sorting. Guys would come in looking for books on World War II history. I started seeing and interacting with people in a way I never thought I would, and learning about all the human diversity there was walking in and out of the store, and in and out of Houston Street, in and out of downtown San Antonio. We had other visitors entering our store. One in particular was this really sweet, pleasant old German fellow. In cold weather, he would show up in tweed. He had a fedora to complement his coat. He was an author, a retired scientist, and we had his book in our store. He was such a nice guy that we did not want to tell him his book was not really moving off the shelves, so ahead of anticipated visits from him, we would take some copies off the shelf so when he showed up, we could let him believe that copies had been selling. On other days, we would put the book back to make it appear we had reordered them. We enjoyed the chats and small talk from him, and he was such a nice guy. Another set of humans inhabited the streets and alleys downtown. They were literally the street people. In the past, they could be called bums, or hobos, or ne'er-do-wells, dropouts. The first experience with one I recall vividly, an old man walking purposely past our door screaming out for all to hear, "They've got control of my computer. They have control. My computer. They got control of my computer." He would scream this up and down the streets. What I did not understand, and probably refused to accept because I was hung up on the New Age mysticism, a detail in my life I do not wish to revisit, the man was mentally ill. He was one of too many who in earlier days would be confined to what was then called a state hospital. That particular euphemism was the milder reference to what we used to be called insane asylums, and there were other terms. At that time in my life, I was not really coming to the realization, but I was dealing with a case of mental illness in my family. Many others in other families were coping with their own. My understanding of what the then term mentally ill was too much influenced by the movies. The Three Faces of Eve, Montgomery Clift playing Sigmund Freud, the classic and still very moving film The Snake Pit with Olivia de Havilland. The reality was a far greater issue that few people really want to deal with to this day. Psychology, through the decades, was, as history now shows, a near sham field of inquiry. There was a prolonged endeavor to understand mental illness, to define it, and to treat it. The major proponents of the field in the early 20th century were the familiar Freud, Jung, Adler, and a host of other little fishes. Jung would have conversations with outright schizophrenic people and declare the person to be in communication with a collective unconscious that manifested ancient archetypes from mythology and proved there was a religious component to human psyches that had to be reconciled. Freud would be in a conversation with a psychotic person and come to the conclusion that that person suffered the consequences of a repressed trauma that was likely psychosexual. Adler would converse with a person in severe depression and try to guide that person to a point of self-realization and offer personal reinvention, a method inspired by Nietzschean philosophy. One glaring example of the appalling pseudoscience, presumed cause of autism, known as refrigerator mothers. The accusation against some young mothers for not giving the love and attention their child needed to develop normally. A cruel and baseless assumption. All these highly and influential scientists were just wrong, and were eventually proved so by the later fields of neurophysiology and neurochemistry. The entire field of traditional psychotherapy was exposed as a nest of near charlatanism, hucksterism, and pseudoscience. There were sincere efforts, and some successful, in bringing some people out of a neurotic state. Mentally ill people, it turned out, had problems with their brains. Much later, there were born a host of pharmacological treatments that would allow people thus afflicted to gain some functional control of their lives. Antipsychotic medicine came of age in the late 60s and early 70s, resulting in a leap of budgetary restrictions on housing mentally ill people. The afflicted souls were given prescriptions for various afflictions that would help them be in control of their psychoses and allow them to participate in society. With that, the populations of mental health institutions and state hospitals and lunatic asylums were emptied, and the only real therapeutic results were with the state and local comptrollers of the budget, who could eliminate the costs of housing people who were suffering organic afflictions in their brains. The drugs reduced the violent acting out and dramatic episodes, but the poor souls let loose were still crazy. So the recently released mental patients became part of the downtown milieu, and many were frequent visitors or were commonly cited in their recurrent wanderings. There was an elderly Spanish fellow, claimed to be, who had a very sweet disposition. He was a regular visitor, tended to wear a sport coat and a beat-up fedora and other shabby attire from Goodwill, but he felt comfortable in it. He would stay and chat for a while, usually threw in a few denunciations of Richard Nixon, and then return to mellow topics. One particularly poignant visit, he told a tale of having been invited to dinner at a home of a wealthy man who could converse on any topic. The host would play the piano, and he heard selections from great classical composers emitted by the host's piano. The old Spanish guy had a marvelous recollection of being entertained in an atmosphere of class, comfort, and friendship. Hearing that tale made me sad. I was seeing too much reality start to come in and go out of the front door of the store. Sometimes perfectly normal appearing people would walk in and start a conversation, as did one fellow who asked me about all the books in the store. And I told him about all our subject sections, he could browse if he were interested. My recollection of the conversation with him was to the effect, "I guess there is a lot of knowledge in some of these books you sell." I replied, "Yes, but we are a small bookstore and our selection is not great." "But what do those books offer?" And I answered, "Well, we have a science section and history, have some religion." He injected, "Religion, eh?" I said, "Yes." "You know," he began, "there are many believers in many churches who read books like you have." I answered, feeling a twinge in my gut, "Well, yes, of course, many churchgoers, many churches. But what those churches and believers need to experience," I started feeling really icky here, "is to have someone bring such truth to those believers as to raise the roof off those churches and bring them to the real truth." "Yes, I am sure that will happen someday," I replied. I was really feeling icky. "But I am here to tell you now, it is time to raise the roof off those churches." He started really getting weird here. "I am sure that will, the time is nigh to bring the truth to those churches." He started to get really weird. At this point, a customer asked about a book, and I offered to go to the section to help him find it. Fortunately, that ruse worked, and by the time I got back to the cash register, the roof raiser had gone. But he looked so normal. My experience of the areas around downtown were varied. The junior college I attended was nearby, as were other places where I went on various errands or tasks. There was a frequently appearing homeless guy who hung out mainly in the Metropolitan Library, but he showed up here and there. Once he was in a coffee shop where I went to grab a bite to eat. He sat way back in a corner, drinking a mug and having a meal. But his presence was noticeable to all the diners because he carried on animated conversations with himself. At some moments, he would make some loud, assertive statement as if in an argument, but then settle into a normal voice and continue his dialogue. The interesting thing about all this was the customers, and it left a mark on me. The people at their tables would glance over at the old fellow, then look away, and at each other, and smirk and smile and giggle. There was an actual crazy person in their midst, and the best reaction was to chuckle and giggle with some obvious discomfort. The mark all that left on me was a reality that mental illness in others caused quite some discomfort in the groups around it. If that guy had been in a wheelchair or if he were blind, there would certainly be some deference to him, some sympathy. But the reactions were chuckles and snide comments and discomfort because the guy was crazy. That made me wonder if mental illness did not engender a phobic reaction in people. Also made me wonder if the people who were declared insane caused a fear of phobia in society that justified the abhorrent treatment and abuse suffered by so many in so many centuries. The old guy in the restaurant was seemingly everywhere downtown, and over time, there came a change over him. He started rather nondescriptly, in ill-fitting pants and shirts and beat-up third-hand shoes, the complete Goodwill Industries or Salvation Army donation ensembles. But one sighting had him wearing khaki pants that seemed good fits for him. And for some reason, during the week, he stuck to that attire. Later, he acquired a khaki shirt, and it seemed to be a perfectly adequate fit. Weeks later, he had acquired some black boots, laced up military style. Again, more weeks passed, and he had acquired a brown cap with a black or brown leather brim. It looked like the cap of a bus driver. We had Greyhound and Continental Railways buses back then, downtown. Later, it got stranger. Somehow, the fellow found a black belt with a black shoulder strap. The shoulder strap went through the right capulet of his khaki shirt. He was seen all over downtown, and he must have raised some concern in his newly cobbled military attire. It appears his frequent visits to the Metro Library was feeding his apparel design, but what was he reading or examining to guide his evolving manifestation? How were people in the library reacting to him? And one day I heard some people commenting that the old man who carried out conversations with himself had appeared on the library steps in what appeared to be an Earth's Realm-inspired ensemble of brown shirt uniform. Later, I was startled when the other feature they described appeared on his left arm. I saw it. A white cloth with a badly drawn swastika forming an armband. The guy was on a mission to become a Nazi. Something in him drove him to adopt that attire. All the time he scooted around in that offensive ensemble, he kept alive the conversation with himself. And that was one of many introductions to life. Many months later, I left the bookstore and stumbled my way into a career a few years after that. The recollections of my time in the bookstore were not all that pleasant. It was rather disappointing to have been in the bookstore and not enjoyed the experience. I eventually was appalled at my decisions about life and my inability to accept things I saw and things I heard, especially around San Antonio de Bears circa 1974. I thought I put all that behind me. Then one evening, 20 years later, I was watching a documentary on TV. It was one of the many retrospectives about World War II, only this one was about the immediate aftermath and the struggle between the Allies, USA versus Great Britain versus USSR, to grab up all the technology the Germans had developed, especially the rocketry and aviation knowledge, plus others. The ultra-secret program by the USA was known as Operation Paperclip, and its function was to grab hardware, engineering design, scientific expertise in various fields and smuggle it all to the United States. The unfortunate bit about all that was the scientific talent kidnapped from Germany, such people as Wernher von Braun, all had the stink of criminality and atrocity on them, and there were questions raised about how these German scientists were given high-level management roles and positions of prestige in the later Cold War-era technology rush. While watching the documentary, a name was mentioned, Dr. Hubertus Strughold. It turns out Dr. Strughold wrote a book entitled Your Body Clock, all about the physiological adaptation to day-night cycles and the consequences of intentional air travel disrupting biological clocks, other issues. It was published in 1971. While a scientist for Nazi Germany, Strughold oversaw a research program that used human experiments in high-altitude stressors, extreme temperatures, and other aeronautical research pursuits. There was, to this day, strong evidence that experiments on human subjects was conducted with concentration camp inmates, and some were quite brutal, amounting to torturous cruelties and even possible lethalities in human subjects. High-altitude pressure and temperature regimes, sudden exposure to extreme low pressure, immersion in salt water chilled to near zero centigrade. Appalling experiments actually conducted with some level of suspicion about Strughold having knowledge of these. Strughold held a prominent position in the then Brook Air Force Base Flight Medicine and High-Altitude Chamber Facility, and was a close advisor to NASA in designing pressure suits, as well as experimental knowledge gained about human endurance and extreme flight regimes. How he gained that knowledge and expertise is thought to be disturbing, upon reflection. But he was such a nice guy. He was a nice old guy, and we kept encouraging him about how well his book was selling. So that brought me back to the bookstore. There were two insanities that have left a mark on me, and I'm not sure how to process them. A psychotic street dweller who is being tortured by a brain that is badly malfunctioning to the point he tries to reinvent himself as a Nazi, perhaps in an effort to overcome the torment. And another man who was a kindly intellectual who earned his career in the USA by having participated in another psychotic deviation that was the sickening madness of his era. These memories come and go. From San Antonio de Béjar in Texas in the USA, this is Thomas Booker for Bondi Tunes International. Music used under the narration is John Bolcom's Rags as performed on the piano by John Murphy. I strongly recommend that music. I do not recommend the Nazi music.
Bondi Tunes International.
This is Bondi Tunes International broadcasting around the world. I'm Henry on Bondi Beach in Sydney, Australia. Now, he's an author, a poet, a writer, TV critic, essayist, and presenter on television. Clive James was Australian, but made most of his success in Britain. He died last week, aged 80. Adam Devlin joins me now from Melbourne, our correspondent there. Is it fair to say, Adam, and by the way, welcome to the show.
Thank you, welcome.
Is it fair to say that he was a bit of a larrikin?
Oh, absolutely. He was the quintessential Aussie larrikin let loose on the streets of London in the 1960s. Mm. And ascorbic wit, vibrant personality, incredible sense of humour. Mm. And couple all of that with, a literary genius just made him irresistible to a lot of people, me included.
In those days, we have a thing called the tall poppy syndrome in Australia. He broke through that invisible wall, didn't he?
He did, absolutely. And he did it, I think, for a couple of reasons. And one of the things that Clive James had, one of the qualities that he had as a communicator or a writer, as a presenter, was that his work was incredibly intellectual. But he presented it in an everyday, common bloke sort of manner. Mm. So, whereas some of his Australian contemporaries, like Germaine Greer or Robert Hughes, were very much victims of the tall poppy syndrome here in Australia. Now, just for those people listening overseas that may not understand what we mean by the tall poppy syndrome, we have this thing in Australia where if you become too successful,
you're looked down on.
The establishment in Australia will try to cut you down because you're a poppy that's got taller than all the rest, so you must be leveled off. And a lot of Australians who go overseas and find success have dealt with that. Clive James basically sidestepped it, and I think the reason for that was that, as I said, he had this common approach, and when you listen to him talk, when you see him on TV, He had a very ochre Australian accent, which he held right through to the end of his days.
Yes,
So there was not a lot of pomposity about him.
No, not at all. And it's interesting, I'm about to play this clip where he is with Robert Hughes in a studio, I think on the BBC in 1968, and they were talking about beatniks. Take a listen.
What do you do, Clive, at the university?
I study English literature.
Oh, you're a poet.
That sort of thing.
You've got a book there by the famous On the Road by Kerouac.
Jack Kerouac himself, yeah.
Would you read a bit for us, just to give us some idea of the kind of material that a beat writes?
Well, when I read this, I'm not making any overt criticism of it. I'd just like you to notice, for one thing, this superfluity of adjectives, which seems to me to indicate a lack of discipline, and it seems to me to be innate in beat culture generally. Listen to this. Suddenly I had a vision of Dean, a burning, shuddering, frightful angel, palpitating toward me across the road, approaching like a cloud, with enormous speed, pursuing me like a shrouded traveller on the plain, bearing down on me. I saw his huge face over the plains with the mad, bony purpose and the gleaming eyes. I saw his wings. I saw his old jalopy chariot with thousands of sparking flames shooting out from it. I saw the path it burned over the road. It even made its own road and went over the corn, through cities, destroying bridges, drying rivers. It came like wrath to the west. I knew Dean had gone mad again.
Now, you talk about accents. Do you hear the terribly British accents coming from the other two guys? And then you got Clive James with his broad Australian accent.
Yes, and let's not forget that Robert Hughes and Clive James were a similar age, and they both grew up in Sydney. Well, certainly Australia. I'm not sure now where Robert Hughes grew up. I think it was Sydney. But, you know, they were certainly Australian contemporaries. And when you listen to that, you would not think that.
Yes, it's true. And, you know, if you're familiar with Sydney, he was born in Cogra, which is a suburb south, the south end of Sydney. Pretty working class suburb, too.
Absolutely. So, particularly then when he grew up. And, you know, he was he grew up basically with a single mother, which would not have been easy. His father died on the way home from the war.
That's right, yeah.
And so he, you know, at that time, it would have been hard for his mother to be raising a child on her own. There weren't the welfare resources available that there as they are today. So I think that also adds a little to why he sidestepped the tall poppy syndrome, is that his story was well known to Australians, and people could relate to him. And because he didn't put on airs and graces, because he maintained that ochre accent, the Australian people sort of said to him, well, you know, good on you for having a go, and good on you for making it, which is interesting.
Yeah, and he went there in 1961. I had no idea that he went there so early. And really, you know, as that clip we just played, I think it was from the BBC in 1968, he actually was a writer for television for years. Apart from that particular broadcast, he really was writing for TV. He was not actually, he didn't have his own TV show, Adam.
No, that's true. And of course, he started out as a literary critic in newspapers.
Oh, yes.
And that progressed into his TV work. First of all, as you know, a guest on shows talking about things, and then of course he got his first own show, and sort of he went on from there. But yeah, just the sort of person. And again, this goes back to what I was saying a moment ago. His writing style was such that it appealed to the literati and the intellectual sect that he was a part of, yes, because it had layers to it, and it was he was a brilliant wordsmith, but he also infused enough commonality into his writing so that, if I can use the term, the common man could understand what he was saying, and it was accessible to both the literati and the man on the street.
We mentioned that, you know, he was a larrikin. He was also, you know, what I find interesting about this man is that later in life he was very, very honest, you know, and we'll be playing some audio clips of Clive James later on in his life talking about his infidelities.
Yes. You know, that's, I think, the mark of a good writer. A writer needs to write what is real to them. And if you're going to say, you know, my personal life, my private life, what's happening to me internally is to be excluded from my work, well, then you're going to struggle to be a successful writer. And so I think Clive James had a very clear and innate understanding of that. And he really developed throughout his career the cult of personality around himself. So he became a bit of a personality. And that was because he was honest with us,
yes,
as a presenter, as a communicator, you know, tinged with comedy. Of course, everything he did was tinged with comedy on TV. But underlying all of that was an absolute basis of fact.
And it's interesting that he hit the British audience pretty hard, became really successful over there. And as we said earlier on, not too many Australians made it big, certainly not on television in Britain at the time.
No. I mean, there was, though, and looking back now, Henry, it was a bizarre time. There was, you know, in that early 60s period, you had a group of Australians go to England. You had Robert Hughes, who we mentioned a moment ago, the famous art critic. We had, of course, Barry Humphreys, Who's still going strong. We had Clive James, and of course we cannot forget Germaine Greer.
No, we cannot. She won't let us.
No. And it's bizarre to think that these four people just turned up in London as, you know, these dirty, unwashed Aussies.
Yes.
And and within a very short period of time, they were pretty much running the literary joint.
Yes.
Between them all. Like, they just... They really just fitted in to the London arts and cultural scene like a jigsaw piece.
Yes. And, of course, it was the early 60s, mid-60s, late 60s. It was a crazy time anyway, wasn't it?
Huge social upheaval. A lot of... you know, the 60s really were... was a decade of questioning, you know, questioning where we've come from, why we do the things we're doing, and where we're going in the future. It really was one of those rare decades where everything was being questioned.
Clive James recently spoke on the BBC about his life, his infidelity, and being a lucky man. Take a listen.
No, I'm lucky. And things would be very different if I were in pain or if I was even uncomfortable. I wouldn't be able to concentrate and I wouldn't be able to do all this writing and reading and viewing. And that would be very different. So I've been lucky. And I counted the whole thing as a stroke of luck. Mm. I've had a reasonably long life. I probably deserved to get caught. I mean, someone who smoked like I did should have something wrong with him. And so I don't complain. And if it hurt, I would probably complain. I'm not so sure how brave I would be.
In terms of your career, how do you describe yourself?
I'm at the peak of my career. No question of it. I'm a better writer now than I ever was. And here's the secret. I've got more to write about. I can write about life now. When the end is in sight, you get a perspective on life you never had before. I was just too dumb and too energetic. I was just moving forward at the high speed of a thrown shoe. I wasn't reflective. I'm much more reflective now.
What do you reflect on?
Everything. What I did wrong as well as I did right. I'll be a little bit trepidatious inviting you to ask me all the things I did wrong. There's a long list of them. We'll probably get to it. And I'll stall you. I'll give you a bad time.
give me some examples.
I could have been, well... I was not a faithful husband. I should have been, but I wasn't. I've apologized for it to the person who matters. I can't be proud of myself on that score. I try and be proud of the fact that I'm still married to the only person I ever did marry. I'd like that to count for something.
Has she forgiven you?
Forgiveness is a big deal. But if I'm alive, then I've been forgiven.
As I was saying, he was very honest towards the end. He also did, he spoke to 7:30 Report, which is an ABC program here in Australia. His honesty was something that hit you in the face. It really does, you know. He just seemed to say it as it is, you know, like...
Absolutely. And, you know, the fact that he said, you know, that he had been unfaithful and that was, you know, he'd you know, made amends with the only person that matters.
Mm-hmm. That's his wife, yeah?
Absolutely. Tells us two things about him. One is, you know, his unflinching honesty with us, his audience. Mm. But B, also... the mark of the man in that, you know, he's not, he didn't go into any further detail. He didn't, you know, go into what happened when he told his wife. He didn't go into, you know, the inner workings of his marriage. He just basically said, this happened. I eventually confronted and told my wife about it. And the important thing is we're still together.
Yes. Amazing.
And so we understand exactly what's going on, but we don't know the finer detail. And he's done it in such a way, which is very clever, because we're not left asking any questions.
Mm, that is clever.
Mm. So he had that ability to tell us what he wanted to tell us, which was grounded in honesty, grounded in his real life, but did it in such a way that you felt full at the end of the conversation. you weren't wanting for more information.
I want to actually just play Clive James on the ABC here in Australia about a year ago, and he talks here about his battle with cancer.
You got terribly sick.
Yeah, these books are all around me, and they'll be here when I go, and I'm that sick. I just don't know when it ends, but in 2010 I got really ill, and leukemia was one of the things I was diagnosed with, and eventually it will switch me off. So it raises the question, what do you do? Do you lie down, give up, read the Bible, or do you go on as you were, reading and writing? And I've done the second, and I've just done a little book called Latest Readings, which is about the books I've been reading lately, and I could do another volume of that because I'm still reading.
The accent's still there. You've lived here for so many years, but how much of you is still Australian or still resides in Australia?
A large part of what I rather boastfully call my mind is still about as Australian as a lawn full of bindi eyes, and will be right to the end. I write a lot of poems set in Australia.
What is it about that country that
well,
draws you?
Well, it's my mission to tell the Australians from abroad in my work that Australia is a wonderful place. I always thought so. When I was young, I never believed that Australia was anything else except blessed. I thought it was a little dull when I was young, but that was because I was a snob. And I learned better when I came away. But if I hadn't come away, I wouldn't have realised that the world is not like Australia, for example. There are whole areas of the world that are nothing like Australia at all. And how do you tell the young in Australia how privileged they are? Well, you can't really.
He survived a lot longer than I thought he would, Adam.
I think he survived a lot longer than he thought he would, too.
Yes, this is true.
You know, it's funny when, you know, even talking about his you know, death, which was obviously going to happen sooner as opposed to later at that point in his life.
Yeah.
You know, he was still joking about it, you know, still saying that, you know, and he said, you know, I was meant to just walk out of the studio and go and die in the garden.
only he would say that.
And I didn't do that. Mm. And almost apologising for the fact that he's still alive and still doing this stuff. So, it'd be very interesting.
And he did mention that one of his great sadness, was that he would never be able to come back to Australia.
Yeah.
That must have been difficult.
Absolutely. And look, although he spent a vast amount of his adult life outside of Australia, there are a couple of pointers that just tell me that he loved Australia and he always considered Australia to be his home. And one of the most forward things of that, Henry, would be the fact that he never lost his Australian accent.
No.
You know, there's a certain number of Australians, many of them now, that go overseas and form a career within the arts or entertainment industries.
Yeah.
Not many of them, though, keep their Australian accent.
No, and especially at the time, there was a tendency to get all British on people. If you've just joined us, I'm talking with Adam Devlin in Melbourne about author, poet, writer, TV critic, essayist, and TV presenter Clive James. Who went to Britain in 1961 and forged basically a new life for himself. And as we say, he was really sad about not being able to come back to Australia. I want to talk about some of the more serious stuff that he did, because basically his TV show on ITV in Britain was comedy. But here's an interesting clip from an interview he did with actor Carrie Fisher. Take a listen.
Let's find out what you thought of the week's big news. Hillary Clinton's late mother-in-law has posthumously brought out a book describing Hillary as a frump. Have you met Hillary?
I sat next to her at an award gala in Los Angeles and told her I would guide her through a lot of the gossip for the evening. But she was sitting next to this mogul who escorted her, and they all sort of, everybody, these incredibly powerful people came over pretending to sort of want to talk to the mogul, which they did, but they really wanted to meet the First Lady. That's our royalty, you know? So they were all squeezing in their lobes. And I was sitting next to her like this goose watching this whole thing go on. It was quite a lot.
Did you know some of these guys, these powerful figures?
Incredibly powerful people acting all sort of silly and goosey and shriveled.
It sounds like you need a royal family. You've got one, but maybe you should have a permanent royal family.
We could borrow some of yours.
Yeah, yeah. We seem to have a few to spare lately. Carrie, you must be the last smoker in L.A. Do you feel like a social outcast? I've seen you smoking a cigarette just today.
That was not a cigarette. No. thank you. My mom. No, I always felt like a social outcast anyway, so I might as well smoke, right?
Rumors are going around that smoking will actually be banned throughout America, like prohibition, you know? So what will you do if that happens?
I'll smoke my patches.
You mean you've tried to give up and you've had patches slapped on?
I put patches all over.
Just for smoking? Your patches were...
No, I got patches for everything.
And, you know, he was an amazing communicator. In whatever field he turned his hand to, whether it be the writing of poetry, whether it be essays, whether it be social commentary, lyrics, poems, or sit-down face-to-face interviews like we just heard. He was incredibly good at communicating with people, and he had that way of just disarming the person he was talking to.
Yes.
And bringing them to a point where they were happy to just sit there and laugh along and expose their lives to him and through him to us with absolute ease. Now, Carrie Fisher is notoriously bad and difficult to interview, or was before she passed away.
Is that right?
Yeah. She didn't like giving interviews. She was often surly in interviews. And there's none of that in that clip that we just heard, which goes to show how good he is at making people at ease to talk to him.
Well, you know, we have a saying on this very radio show that we don't actually interview people, we just have a chat. And you get that feeling when you're listening to... They could be, you know, having a whiskey next to a fireside kind of chat, you know, that kind of thing.
Absolutely. But it's not, you know... When you said that, a fireside chat, what came into my mind was a picture of Michael Parkinson.
Yes, absolutely.
Who does that so well. But Clive James was something extra on top of that for me, in that he, with Parkinson, it was always an interviewer and an interviewee. With Clive James, it was just, it often descended into two people who admire each other just sitting down having a conversation.
And that's exactly what it was, wasn't it?
Absolutely. And personally, I found that much more effective and much more entertaining to watch.
And he also did, and we'll just play a clip of this too, the Endurance Japanese Game Show. this is lovely stuff. It's hard to explain on radio, but he was following a Japanese game show, and they're known, an Endurance Japanese Game Show. Take a listen to this.
Here beside the Nile, strapped to a wooden framework from which they can't escape, they are dusted with powdered fish food. Hungry catfish wait in the river for the contestants to join them for lunch.
See, there's a man who covered everything, didn't he? He did comedy, he did serious stuff. I want to talk about his poetry, because you're a poet yourself. And if I think you mentioned off air that you might have some quotes from Clive James. Did you read much of his poetry? Was this mostly serious stuff?
Look, I did. Certainly when I was younger, when I started writing poetry in my early teens. And I went through a period of time where I was obsessed with Germaine Greer, I was obsessed with Robert Hughes, I was obsessed with Barry Humphries, I was obsessed with Clive James. So, yes, I did read a fair bit of his poetry. some of it was amazing. Some of it just touched me in places that I never thought a piece of literature could touch me. Mm. Some of it, you know, I didn't quite get. I didn't quite understand.
Fair enough, yeah.
But that's poetry, you know. But certainly the one thing his reading or his poetry never was for me was boring. Mm. Even if I didn't quite understand where he was going with a piece of prose or poetry, even if I didn't quite get the angle he was aiming for, it was still captivating for me to read it.
Mm. And did his poems do well?
Absolutely.
Poetry's not an easy thing to sell, is it?
Well, it's not, Henry. And, you know, if I was to ask you this, how many people do you know have gone out and bought a book of poetry?
None. Not one, do I know. Maybe you.
Yes, I do buy books of poetry, I have to say. But, yeah, even, you know, I dabble around the fringes of the literary scene here in Melbourne, and poetry's just... it doesn't really get much attention. Although I have to say, in Melbourne at the moment, there is a little bit of a resurgence in what they call slam poetry.
Oh.
Where it's an open mic situation where poets turn up at a venue, usually a bar or a coffee shop or something, but normally a bar with alcohol involved.
Hopefully.
Yeah. And you put your name on a list and you get called out, and then you go up and you recite a piece of poetry, and then the audience... you know, applaud or boo or whatever, if they like it or love it or loathe it. And you know, at the end of the night, there's a bit of a competition and a winner is picked.
Right.
And that was big in the 60s as well, particularly in London. And so it's good to see that is re-emerging here in Melbourne at the moment.
Do you think that, you know, obviously he's from Sydney,
yes,
from Kogra. Do you think that Sydney and Australia in general in the 1960s simply didn't have the wherewithal for people like him?
Absolutely. These intellectual giants, the four that I've mentioned, Australians who went to the UK, to London in the 60s, they really had to leave Australia. They just couldn't have done what they did with their careers if they had stayed in Australia in the 60s.
Mm.
We just didn't have the infrastructure here. We didn't have the mechanisms for them to get their stuff out to the world, because it had never been done, really. So
it has to be remembered, there was no internet, television. No. There was only two or three channels in Australia. We didn't get that much of international television, it's fair to say.
No, and there really wasn't much of a market for a smart aleck TV critic.
Which is what he was.
Which is essentially what he was. Mm. Or a poet, or a beatnik poet. I mean, again, not a big call for that in Australia in the 1960s. So
were we really... were we really sort of in the middle of nowhere? I mean, technically we are, but we've got technology now. But in those days, even for yourself growing up in Australia, I know you grew up in a small town, but even in the cities like Sydney and Melbourne and Brisbane, do you think that we were still kind of in the middle of nowhere, globally speaking?
We were still hideously isolated from the rest of the world, both geographically and psychologically.
Yes.
We felt as a nation that we were isolated from the rest of the world, and we didn't feel good enough to compete with the rest of the world on many aspects, particularly in the arts.
A tendency of insecurity at the time.
Absolutely. And again, this ties into, we mentioned the tall poppy syndrome at the beginning of this, and yes, that also tied into that. It was like, don't get too big for your boots. You're only an Australian.
Yep, you're only an Australian.
The rest of the world isn't going to want to know what you're thinking. we're not good enough.
And himself and the big three, you know, Jermaine and Robert, they really proved Australia wrong with that, didn't they?
Absolutely. And look, they really did open up Australia to the art world globally. Mm. You know, they were trailblazers, particularly because, and Clive was the most sort of prominent in this area, they were particularly proud of the fact that they were Australian.
Yes.
And that was a new thing on the international stage.
Definitely.
Previously, you would, they, you know, Robert Hughes is a good example of this. He went to England and he all of a sudden he had an English accent. but let's not forget, this is at this era, TV newsreaders had British accents in Australia.
Look, even in the 80s, as a newsreader myself on radio, I had a slightly English accent. It was just the dumb thing at the time. I mean, you talk about this, you know, if you look at footage here in Australia, Movie Tone and all those, these are Australians with terribly British accents.
More British than the British.
Yes. so true.
And it's funny, this is getting a slightly off topic, but I read an Evelyn Waugh novel called The Loved Ones many years ago, and it deals with expatriate British people living in Hollywood. And he paints these scenes in the book of these 1950s British people living in Hollywood.
Yes.
As 1850s British people.
It's really bizarre.
who had become more British than the British because they were away from home. And to a large degree, up until sort of the 1970s, really, that was Australia as well.
Yeah, absolutely. You don't have any poem material from him handy, do you?
The only one I've got right here now is his final poem.
Yes, I'm actually going to play that at the end of this show.
Yeah, I actually was going to ask if I could recite that, and then I saw that you've got him reciting it.
Well, give us a little bit of what it's about anyway.
He's probably slightly better at doing it than me.
Okay.
I'm man enough to admit that.
Well, now, you know, this is something you always ask about people who die. What do you think his legacy was?
Look,
where do you start with a guy like this?
Well, when you've got somebody with so many, you know, angles to their career, you know, his TV shows really did crack open a new genre of TV talk shows. His books of his critical books, his books on social commentary and social awareness and where we're going as a society, you know, written some in the 70s are still just as relevant today as they were then. Mm. And then on top of that, you've got his poetry and his essays. So, you know, I think he's going to be remembered for three main fronts. One is for his television work. He'll absolutely be remembered as an amazing poet. Mm-hmm. And essayist, and then you've also got his, you know, his social commentary books that just are staggeringly interesting when you read them.
Okay.
And he had this ability, Henry, to talk about an everyday topic, make it sound intellectual, but still approachable for the common man. It's very bizarre how he did that. You know, I remember some of his TV specials when he was in America that he did in the 80s. I think it was the late 80s. He did a couple of specials where he would go to places in America. And, you know, there's one quote from him that I just love. And it says, this is a very short quote. It says, "The thing about making a documentary in Las Vegas is that there isn't much to film apart from other people making documentaries about Las Vegas."
Brilliant. That's so him, isn't it?
Absolutely, you know. Mm. So, you know, he's taking the piss out of himself because he's there doing a documentary and everyone else is there doing the same sort of documentary.
Yeah.
But he has a way of reflecting on that, which shows that his intellect is above the rest of them because he's actually putting it back onto everyone else.
Absolutely, yes.
Just brilliant stuff, brilliant stuff.
Do you have any other quotes from him at all handy?
I do have a couple. Now, he was very witty. He had an ascorbic wit, and he loved the cult of celebrity. So I've just got a couple of celebrity quotes here that I think are very, very funny.
Sure.
The first one, "Arnold Schwarzenegger looks like a condom full of walnuts."
Wonder what Arnie thought of that.
Yeah. There's another one here. It's John McEnroe has hair badly burnt. Sorry. John McEnroe has hair like badly turned broccoli.
Yeah, okay.
there's another one here. I like this one. "Delivering the State of Union, that bloke couldn't deliver pizza."
Oh, who Beyonce, was he talking about Beyonce. In that one?
I don't know. I need to do. Some I need just saw that one no went on air. I want to have a look at it. Look, it could be any of them apart from Obama.
Yes, that's understandable.
There's another one here. Beyonce and Pathos are strangers. Amy Winehouse and Pathos are flatmates, and you should see the kitchen.
That's great stuff.
But look, you know, just his famous quote on Marilyn Monroe: "She was good at being inarticulately abstracted for the same reason that midgets are good at being short."
Where does he get this stuff from?
And, you know, he just... you'll get a laugh out of this one. The British Secret Service was staffed at one point almost entirely by alcoholic homosexuals working for the KGB.
I wonder if there's any truth in that.
Everything he said was founded in truth.
Yep, fair enough. Okay, we've got to go soon. Anything else?
Look, I just want to say to him a huge thank you for myself personally, because, as I said, when I started writing poetry, he was an inspiration for me, not only because of the type of writing that he was doing, but the way that he did it, the fact that he was, in many regards, similar to me. He was from a working-class Aussie family who pursued his goal to be a writer, and he succeeded. Now, you know, I haven't quite got to that level of success yet, but he remains to this day an inspiration for me. And so for a young Adam growing up looking for somebody who's done what I'd wanted to do, he was one of the very few people that I could look at and go, well, there's a path I can follow. There's somebody who's done it.
Yeah.
And so to me, that was invaluable. And I know obviously he'll never hear this, but you know, to me, he was a personal hero, somebody that I had ultimate respect for, and you know, the world is just a little less bright without him in it.
Okay, Adam, thank you so much for joining me on Bondi Tunes International.
It's a pleasure, Henry.
And we'll go out with Clive James reading his farewell poem, Japanese Maple.
Your death, near now, is of an easy sort. So slow a fading out brings no real pain. Breath growing short is just uncomfortable. You feel the drain of energy, but thought and sight remain. Enhanced, in fact. When did you ever see so much sweet beauty as when fine rain falls on that small tree and saturates your brick-back garden walls, so many amber rooms and mirror halls, ever more lavish as the dusk descends? This glistening illuminates the air. It never ends. Whenever the rain comes, it will be there, beyond my time, but now I take my share. My daughter's choice, the maple tree is new. Come autumn and its leaves will turn to flame. What I must do is live to see that. That will end the game for me, though life continues all the same. Filling the double doors to bathe my eyes, a final flood of colours will live on as my mind dies. Burned by my vision of a world that shone so brightly at the last and then was gone.
Henry O'Donovan.